Good morning, everyone. My name is David Lindahl. I was told to say that because I'm on the webcam. And I just wanted to start by telling you I'm going to present on XC, which is a set of technologies that a team of people have worked on over a number of years. And I'm going to go right into talking about those technologies and what I think is really interesting about them. But I just wanted to start by telling you about my interests, because I think I'm not going to talk too much about that in this talk, but I'm really been lucky in my career to get to do something I love, which is invent things. I love inventing things. And inventing things, to me, I've learned how to invent things. It's not something I do on my own. It's something I do with a team of people. And there's two aspects to it, which involve a number of methodologies that I've gotten an opportunity to learn, both when I worked at Xerox Corporation in the research center and now at an academic library, University of Rochester. I've learned how to do something called work practice study, which is a form of ethnography where you learn about people's work by observing them doing their work. You go into the place that they work. You don't sort of, there's lots of different kinds of user research where you sort of have these, you bring people into a conference room and you talk about their work and things like that. But when people talk about their work, they don't always remember the interesting aspects of it. It's very different to watch people work. So we do ethnography, and we capture what we see, and we look for opportunities. People often, when they're doing their work, they work around something. They work around the technology that they're using because it doesn't quite meet their needs. They work around the space that they have. They work around various issues. And those are, when we're doing this research, those are opportunities that we see to make a change to the tools and space that people operate in. And this methodology that I've learned over the years involves making changes, coming up with ideas for technology, and then inserting that back into the workplace and observing to see if that improves the situation. So the way that I've learned this is by working with a number of anthropologists and technologists and designers. And what's really important is this sort of melding of ideas of people from different disciplines and different backgrounds. And I think that's how I've learned to invent things. When I left Xerox and I went to the library world, it was really exciting because Xerox had tons of different disciplines, but libraries are this sort of melting pot of disciplines. There's, especially in this academic library that I work in, there's this huge collection of content, all these professional librarians with different backgrounds and different subject expertise. There's metadata expertise and cataloging expertise. There are technology experts. There's designers. There's a broad range of disciplines, and all the faculty that interact with the library and all the students, all the different generations of people. And we've gotten to do design and build technology and invent things. So when I do a talk about what I'm telling you about right now, a lot of people like to know, what did we learn from our research? Because we've done lots of studies. And I don't like to share that. I'd much prefer to teach people how to do the research, because I think that it's important for libraries to study their users, both the library staff, what the staff is doing, and the end users, what they're doing, and change the way the library works by getting the staff to understand more about how the library is being used, and to inform and to make changes and improve the technology, to know what technology the library needs and to go after that. So this software that I'm going to present is sort of along those lines. We really wanted to empower libraries to be able to study their users, study their staff, understand what is needed, and then take the next step and always be evolving and improving the situation. So this software is sort of along those lines. And it was created by the three leads of the project: myself, background in computer science, Jennifer Bowen, who's a cataloger, and Nancy Foster, who's an anthropologist. So those are the three people who led the team that created the software. Extensible Catalog is open source, user-centered next generation software for libraries. It provides a discovery interface and a set of tools for libraries to manage metadata and build applications. I should just point out for those folks who have heard open source time and time again, it really does refer to software that you can download for free and you can use whenever you want to. But it also refers to a concept and a model where libraries contribute back to the software. So rather than you pay a company and they give you software, this doesn't mean the software is free. It just means that the way that libraries contribute to supporting it is a different model. They might contribute by contributing code, or they might contribute money via donation. So there are necessary economies in the open source world. It's not just gimme, gimme, gimme. The XE software has sort of four main areas of technology. The first is the user interface. It's built on Drupal, which is a web content management system. How many folks have heard of Drupal? Okay. How many of you actually use Drupal? Okay, it's a much smaller number. Anyone who's thinking of deploying Drupal in their library that hasn't yet? Okay. What we've done is we've taken this web content management system, a platform to build your website on, and we've infused it with support for library metadata so that libraries can build websites that use and treat library metadata like any other type of web content, like a web page or a blog posting. It elevates library metadata to web content status in this system. We have a set of metadata tools that do automated metadata processing, enabling libraries to aggregate metadata and run services on it. The third thing we've built is the XE schema, which is a new XML schema that contains terms from Dublin Core, RDA elements, and MARC vocabularies. And it's also a Ferberized schema. And the fourth thing we've built is connectivity tools. And the connectivity tools are really about legacy integrated library systems that most libraries use that really don't have open interfaces to let you create sort of external products that would communicate with the integrated library system. So we've built this layer that is a go-between between any integrated library system. I'm talking about, you know, Voyager and Innovative, Aleph, any system that you might use, the big ones, the small ones, and enable those systems to talk standards so that any next generation discovery environment or other tools that you might want to build can communicate with the ILS. We have lots of partners and contributors, and this is a list. University of Rochester, Andrew W. Mellon Foundation has given us a lot of support. There have been four grants so far from Mellon to this project. The Carly Consortium has contributed significantly. And something exciting, we have vendors who have contributed. Serial Solutions has contributed money, and OCLC has contributed code from a product to our open source software base. We're all over the place. I'm going to present the user interface. This is the public interface first. And you can see our tagline next to XE is take control. And this is really, the user interface is kind of misleading, because you're going to see what a public interface might look like. But our goal when we designed this was not to make decisions for libraries. It was to let libraries make decisions. So anytime we made a decision, it was really just making a decision about the default configuration for when you download this product and install it for your end users, what will it do? We tried to give folks a default that was going to work in, you know, generally well. But every choice we make, we made it an option with a menu that libraries could change and make a different decision, because we didn't want to make the decisions. We wanted libraries, each individual library, to be able to customize the interface for the public the way that they saw fit. And the other thing that I'm going to show you is how closely tied our user interface is to the capabilities of metadata. So we've built a discovery interface and a library web application platform in one. So that means that you're not just building a search tool, you're building a way for you to build other kinds of dynamic web applications. It's faceted, it's Ferberized, it's customizable, like I just said. Drupal has an established open source community. There are thousands and thousands. I think there's about 6,000 contributed add-ons to Drupal in the community, which is amazing. That's probably more than like you can download for Firefox. I'm not sure, but it's quite a rich community of folks who've written code and given it away. And my entire presentation is going to be pictures. I'm going to show you lots of pictures of the interface, lots of diagrams, so you can try and understand what we've done. This is the public interface that I mentioned. It's a it's not the latest version, but it is all captured from a live functioning site. So there's no smoke and mirrors here. This is really the software and what it looks like in a particular iteration. On the left, you see some facets. On the right, there's a search box. This particular demo site has about the equivalent of about 150,000 MARC bibliographic records in it. They were pulled from the University of Rochester catalog and converted into our Ferberized RDA-based schema and stored in Drupal, and then this interface sits on top of them. So just to introduce it, I'm going to do a search. I am searching for Harry Potter. Click search, get some results back. I'm just leaving it up here for a second so you can get a sense. The facets on the left changed. Facets, again, are my definition of a facet is the relationships that exist among the results in the result set. On the right, you see some cover images pulled from Syndetic Solutions. We have a module that does that. You have titles and authors and publisher, date, format, abstract for each of the items. And then on the right, there's this column that tells you why you got these results for your particular query. That column's kind of pointless in this search because you know when you search for Harry Potter and you get Harry Potter back, you know why you got it, right? Okay, but I'll show an example of why that's interesting later. We also have live availability. When this screen is drawn, it talks back to the integrated library system, pulls back the CERC status for these items. And it uses our other toolkits that I talked about, the ILS connectivity toolkits, to do that. This is the full record screen. And again, there's some metadata here. And I'm going to scroll this down. And on the bottom, you can see that we have some other features like related subjects and browse similar items. There's a tab that's similar to the button that might appear in your integrated library system to view the MARC record. In this case, we're viewing the XC schema record because, again, this is all our own schema. And because this is built on Drupal, you can control the permissions. So staff can see an interface that has more buttons in it than the public can see. And you can set up permissions so that certain staff have certain access. And our goal is not that the IT staff have to do everything, but that librarians and catalogers and metadata experts and acquisition staff have access to the buttons that they need to do their work. And we don't have to sort of ask someone to do something for us. This is the XC schema record. It's fully Ferberized. We have works, expressions, manifestations, and item level, group one entities. We also added a holdings level to our schema to support MARC holdings records because it really didn't fit into the existing group one entities. So we actually have a five-level hierarchy in our design for metadata. This viewer views all the records that were used to create this screen and the information for this screen. So we can actually pull information from any level of the hierarchy. And you might, let's say we're talking about a music CD where there'd be multiple works on a single manifestation. This screen would show you all the work records and the manifestation and the expression record, or the expression and manifestation record. So I'm going to scroll this down. Just to show you now, I've scrolled down to see the expression and manifestation levels, and I'm pointing out some of the types of terms that are in here. We have terms from Dublin Core DC terms. We have RDA vocab, and we have XC. XC were some terms that we invented because they didn't exist in DC terms or RDA. And I'll talk about more specifically all this stuff. I'm going to scroll down a little bit further and show you the manifestation level record. You can see at the top there's a XC field called type. The type of this record is manifestation. There's an ID for this record. All records in our system have a unique, globally unique identifier. The reason we have globally unique identifiers is because once you have records, once you have works, expressions, manifestation records, they need to point to each other. And we need a stable mechanism for having a manifestation record point to its parent expression record. And you can see the last row of this particular record, this manifestation record, is XC expression manifested. So in the XC namespace, we've defined expression manifested to be the pointer to its parent record, to its parent expression record. Okay? So the XC schema has Dublin core terms. It has 22 RDA elements and 11 RDA role designators. And it has XC elements that we've defined that contain mark vocabularies and linking fields. The linking fields were the uplinks that I was just describing. It's a subset of RDA chosen to retain the granularity in the current mark data. We did not implement all of RDA elements. We implemented the ones that we felt were the most useful in the context we're working in, which is building a discovery environment. Some of the mark data, frequency, numbering of serials, plate number. So I told you a minute ago that we're doing Ferber Group 1 entities, works, expressions, manifestations. We added in that holdings level, that's the plus, and item level. And if just to help visualize this, if you took a mark XML bibliographic record and turned it into XC schema records, this is a simple example where one bib record might create a single work, a single expression, a single manifestation record. There could be other scenarios where you create multiple works from a bib record, but this is just an example. And I wanted to show you some of the complexity of doing that. You have mark holdings records that link to mark bib records. You also sometimes have holdings data in the bib record, depending on the way the ILS is implemented and things like that. We support all these cases in our software. So the bib record sometimes has holdings data in it, so it can create a holdings record. I mentioned before that everything has a unique identifier. All records that we create have a permanent host repository available on the web that you can go to and retrieve the record. And we automatically create uplinks. And we preserve uplinks that exist in the MARC data when we create the XC data. All this is automatic in our software. We've added in some, and I'm going to come back to everything I'm talking about. I'm going to sort of continue to reinforce and explain how things work. But back to the user interface for the public, we have a link to search WorldCat Identities, jumps to the WorldCat Identities page for this author. We have some features in the way our facets work. If I click on the DVD facet, it's going to limit my search results to just DVDs. You're probably familiar with using faceted interfaces. How many folks have a next-generation catalog with a faceted browsing capability at their library? Okay. So less than half. Okay. I'm going to scroll down this page. Now we're seeing just the Harry Potter results that are DVD formatted. And we got this, The Devil Wears Prada. How many folks saw The Devil Wears Prada? Okay. Remember that part where Miranda demands the next unpublished Harry Potter script? Well, that's in the abstract for this. And over on the right-hand column, you can see that it pulls that part out and shows you why it brought back The Devil Wears Prada for a Harry Potter search. Again, everything on the screen is up to the library whether they want it to be there. So if you don't like the column on the right, you can take it off. If you don't like the way the facets work, you can change the way they work. I did another search here for Big Bang, and this one is showing you that you can resort the results to this misspelling of newest first. And the reason I left that in is because we have an international team that built XC, and the developer who built the Drupal toolkit is in Hungary. And he misspelled the word, and that's fine. But the amount of software and the number of features that he's built are amazing. So I just wanted to take take the spelling mistake as an opportunity to remind me to tell you about Peter Corrali, who built the Drupal Toolkit application. I'm going to show you our date facet. Our date facet lets you limit by date, and it starts at the granularity of centuries. And if you pick the 1900s, it then changes the date facet to go to decades automatically. And then if you pick a decade, it changes the date facet to go to years. So you have an ability to refine your search at different levels of granularity for the date facet. Now, the facets on the left are in a particular order. Authors, creators is a facet, type of content, format, and perhaps your library doesn't want them to appear in this order. They might want to have them in a different order as a default. You can also see that the first three are open and the rest are closed. What I've done is I'm logged in as a user who has administrative privileges. So maybe I'm a librarian who the library has decided should be able to change the look of the user interface. So across the top, I have a menu of admin functions, and I'm going to go into the search interface setup, and I'm going to go into the facets area, and I'm going to click on this default facet group, and I'm going to go to the reorder tab. This is the same list of facets that appeared in the left column, but it's the admin interface for our software. It's all web-based. I can click on, if I want to reorder them, I can say I pick language, and I can drag it up with my mouse. And then I can click Save, and then the order of the facets has been successfully updated. So if I go back to my search interface, now the language facet is the second facet in the order. So libraries have the ability to change the interface without doing any programming. But the language facet is now default closed up. It's collapsed, and all the other ones are not collapsed. Like authors is open, type is open, and format is open. In our plan, I want the first three to be open and the rest to be closed. So how do I fix that? I go back to that menu, and you can see that the first one is not collapsed. The second one is. I want to change that. So if I click Edit, change True to False, save it, and I can also change the fourth one, then all of the first three facets are open and the rest are closed. So again, you can control the way the interface works by default just by clicking on Forms. Now I'm going to log in as a user with, in this case, barcode and last name. Our system supports login through many different kinds of mechanisms because we know libraries have complex authentication systems, and we tried to support a couple of the most popular ones. Once I log in, I get this My Account screen where rather than having to go to the ILS to see my items that are checked out and my items that have requests placed for, they display right in this interface. They're pulled through one of our other toolkits that connects to the ILS. So I have my loaned items, my requested items, and I also have a bookmarked items, which is a feature that's managed on the Drupal system. Because Drupal has all those add-on modules, we wanted to show that off, so we downloaded this module that lets you share an item on Facebook. We didn't write that, but it was really easy to add. You just download it from Drupal.org, and you can add features to the interface. Now I'm going to go into some more complex things. How many folks are familiar with Apache Solr? Show of hands, Apache Solr. Okay, just a couple. So Apache Solr is open source software. We are building free open source software, and we don't want to reinvent the wheel. We want to use things that other people have already built, and it's an indexing tool. It's an indexing tool that enables you to build these interfaces that have the facets in them, the faceted browsing features. And so if we had to build Apache Solr and make it perform well for millions and millions of catalog records, we would never have finished the project. So we got to take advantage of this application and put it into our product. There are some commercial products like Serial's Solutions Summon product that uses Apache Solr as well. So we're using the same tools that some commercial products use. Only ours is free. So I'm going to skip. Oh, I want to show you this. So what's interesting here is Drupal is a content management system. We've taught Drupal how to understand library metadata. And you can teach it how to understand many formats. And we've made a sort of a modular system that lets programmers teach Drupal how to deal with metadata, but you can see that we've taught Drupal the XE schema. And what we have on the bottom of the screen is a list of all the different types of entities and all the different fields that live in each entity. And Drupal is aware of that, so when you have to make choices in the admin interface, it can create these lists of all the field types so that librarians can pick from them and make changes to the way the system works. I'm going to skip past this and show you this facet feature. So, facets. So you saw on the public interface there was a facet called authors contributors, and I'm not a cataloger, but you all know that the concept of author contributor can exist in multiple different metadata fields in the record, right? And so a facet can't just be one field; it has to be a collection of fields to make sense for the user. So the author contributors facet is a bunch of different fields in the record, and there's a mapping between that author contributors facet and the field. And when you download our software, the mapping is set up for you automatically. That's the default that we picked for the library. But the library can change it. The library can create new facets, they can delete facets, and they can change the definition of facets so that perhaps there's another field they want included because of the way their metadata is structured. Perhaps there's a field that they want removed from that facet, so it works differently. So in the public interface, a facet is, again, a relationship that exists among results in the result set. But for library staff who are setting this up, it's a relationship between the name of the facet and a bunch of fields. And this is the editor that lets you edit the way facets work. And this is the editor. This is editing the author's contributors facet. And on the left side, you see the display name is author's contributors. On the right side is this long list of all of our fields. And if I scroll through it, you can see all of the different fields that are mapped to that facet. RDA role author, RDA role composer, XE creator, XE contributor. What else is in there? DC terms contributor, DC terms creator. So we use all these different types of fields in XE schema, and they're all mapped to that. We also have another type of facet called a conditional facet that lets you relabel the values of the fields. So you might have data in your fields that you don't want to display as is in the user interface. So this lets you change one value for another one and have that be what shows up to the user. And you do that with PHP code. Because you can't just we can build an interface for that because we wanted to give you full flexibility there, but we're only giving you a snippet of PHP code, so you don't have to deal with the code for the entire system. You're just dealing with something that specifically relabels one facet value for another. What are we doing? Doing good. I also wanted to show you one other aspect of configuration of this interface, which is when you're looking at the results, the list of results in a search result, and the full record display, all of the metadata that's displayed, the library can decide what metadata is displayed for a result. And we created an editor that lets you display work records, expression records, manifestation records, and DC records, because we support Dublin Core natively in the system, although it's sort of an extra feature. What we're doing is we're displaying manifestation level records in the result screen. And the reason we're doing that is because that's the closest we could come to making it work the way users expect from using MARC bibliographic based results displays. But when you look at an expression record in XE, the software has the ability to pull fields from parent records. So you're displaying an expression record, but you can display fields from the parent works and expressions. And you need to be able to do that. So the software lets you do that. Library catalogs and library software understands more about the meaning of data. You understand that the author field means something, and there's a whole descriptive AACR2 book that talks about what these fields mean. So a computer can understand that, right? But metadata requires really specialized software to deal with it. Library and web pages just can be dealt with by anyone's search engine, right? So the semantic web is about coming up with a really simple way of structuring information so that computers can understand it. without having specialized tools to deal with it. Linked data is a mechanism for exposing and sharing and connecting data on the web. So how do we connect data on the web? Well, if everything has a unique identifier, then information from one website can be related to information from another via computer program. Okay? So we already know that everything on the web has a unique identifier. Like web pages have unique identifiers, images do. They all have a URL. They have a URI, right? But people, places, things don't have URIs. Okay? David Lindahl doesn't have one. I have a Facebook page that has a link to it, but that's not a link to me. That's a link to my Facebook page. So the semantic web requires that we create a URL that points to me. Okay? Now, if you ask a web server, let's say I create one. Okay? I create a technology that will have a URI that represents me. Okay? If I type that in my browser and I ask the web server to give it back, the web server can't give me back. Right? So what it does is it sends an error back. It says, no, I can't give you David Lindahl. You've asked for the real person. I'm going to redirect you to his Facebook page. Okay? This is one of the concepts of linked data. Okay? The concept is that people and things have these identifiers, these URIs, and that there are web servers out there that know how to respond to them. And they respond by saying, no, I can't give you that real world thing. I'm going to send you to a page about it. But that negotiation, that step where it says, no, I can't give you that person, tells the other computer that that's a link to a real world object. A uniform resource identifier, URI, is a string of characters used to identify a URN or a resource. There's two kinds, information resources, like web pages, non-information resources, like me. So this is how you create linked data for me. Am I doing okay? Almost done. You create this thing called an RDF triple. This is how we format information in the linked data way, a subject, a predicate, and an object. So how do I describe, I have an example. David Lindahl is 40 years old. I'm going to turn it into linked data in two steps. David Lindahl is the subject. I need to use a defined vocabulary that explains, you know, I'm using this FOF vocabulary, which is a linked data vocabulary for age. And age has a description. If you go to the website for FOF, you can read what age is, but we all know what age is just by the word. And I'm 40 years old. Everything has to be a URI. So I created a made-up URI for me. I would have to have a server that resolves that and gives that error. There's a URI already for the FOF age vocabulary. And then 40 is just a literal, so you can leave it alone. You don't have to, computer knows what 40 means. Two more slides. David Lindahl knows Jennifer Bowen. This is another example. This is where David Lindahl, FOF, knows Jennifer Bowen. Okay? So we just create some URIs for me and for Jennifer, and we use this URI for FOF. A computer can figure out what that means. And you can easily take a web information on a web page and turn it into this format. So there's a clear path for taking unstructured web data and turning it into information that computers can understand without creating specialized tools. And then creating relationships. So if you have information about me on one website and information about Jennifer on another, and you learn that I know Jennifer, you can create these really powerful experiences for users that help them to understand what's going on and what information's out there. There's lots of information in the linked data world. This would have you believe that linked data is much more successful than it is. And what's cool about XC is that our schema is linked data ready. We're doing one of the really hard parts about linked data. You'll hear about tools that are out there that help you set up linked data, web servers and things like that. But what we're dealing with taking existing MARC data and turning it into data that can be put into the linked data world and used as linked data. And I am going to be done and take some questions. And thank you.
Well, thank you. Sure. So we do have microphones around. Again, reminder, please introduce yourself. Questions for David?
Yes.
Hi, I'm Karen Stone from State Library of Queensland. You talked about in the future being able to bring in DC and other schema. Is this in the context of actually being able to bring in more than just one set of data, so something from your ILS, something from your digital management module, so you actually have more than one data set within the catalogue?
Yes. Actually, we can already support that to some degree. We support multiple ILSs, first of all. So if you're a consortium of libraries and you have multiple integrated library systems, or if you're a single library that has multiple ILSs, you might need to deal with that. You might even have some users on one and some on another. So we can support that mode. But also multiple sources of Dublin Core data. Absolutely, we can support that already. There is a metadata services toolkit, a demo site that's live, that you can go and use. It's linked from extensiblecatalog.org, which is right here on the slide. I would suggest you go there. You can actually go there. You can harvest data from a Dublin Core OAI repository and load it into our demo site. It's just the metadata services piece. It's that tool for librarians, but you'll see it come into the system, and you can process it through services. And if you have questions, you can contact me or folks on the team, and we can help you walk you through playing with our demo site. Sure.
Any more questions? Oh, well, I have one.
Oh, there's one over there, too. So.
Oh, no, I'll let the other ones go, and I can... Yes, there's another question there.
Colleen Cleary from QUT, how do you see the extensible catalogue principle fitting in with resource discovery layers and summons?
Oh, like summon?
Yeah.
So Serial Solutions is actually one of our partners, which is really interesting, right? Because we have a discovery layer in our software as well. I think there's a couple ways that they fit together. One is when we set out to build this project, we set out to build this one monolithic application that did discovery. And we had this conference in Rochester. We invited a lot of bigwigs in the library technology space, which was really fun. And we presented what our plans were, and they all said they criticized them. They tore them apart. So we went back to the drawing board, and we made some changes. And we decided instead of building this one thing, we would break it up into small chunks. And our hope is that libraries will make use of any or all of them, okay? So we have a discovery system, we have a metadata toolkit system, and we have a set of tools for connecting your ILS to our software and anyone else's software. So Serial Solutions is really interested in our tools to connect to an integrated library system, because when you install Summon needs to talk to your institution's ILS, and our metadata tools for cleaning up metadata and making it work better in the Summon environment. So there's a couple of tools in there that are useful for Summon folks to use. Our discovery system is also interesting because it lets libraries experiment with Ferber and user interfaces, and it lets them build their library website in a place that has access to different kinds of metadata. So again, this is really a set of tools for libraries that want to study their users and try things. So I think they fit together. Although perhaps our discovery layer and Summon compete in a little bit, or there are different options for libraries.
Any further questions? Yes, there's one up the back, and we'll make that the last one because we are heading into tea time. Thanks.
Katie McDowell from ACER. I think we'd all like to know, are you a librarian?
No, I'm not. The reason I got into libraries is I used to work for Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, and we would do studies of Xerox customers. And for the last 2 years I was at Xerox, we got to do an ethnographic study of a university library. So for 2 years I studied the work practices of librarians around a teaching and learning collection of slides, and we built software, and we put it into use, and we continued to study them over a period of a couple years. So I really got to learn about library technologies, library practices, and it was really intriguing. So I got, I sort of jumped ship after that and went to work for a library.
Okay, would you please all join me in thanking David for his wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay, morning tea is being served in the foyer. Please be back at 11 for the next session. Also, could all of the guests, please, or guest speakers, remain behind for a photo op. Thank you.